Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 8, what we'll look at today. Genesis chapter 6, beginning verse 1, the Bible says, "When man began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive. And they took as their wives any they chose. Then the Lord said, 'My spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of man, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. So the Lord said, 'I will blot out man whom I created from the face of the land, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens, for I'm sorry that I have made them.' But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord." I think one of the most amusing things for me as a pastor is when people begin to give excuses on the basis of their personality or their abilities. I can't do that. I'm not a people person. You know, I could never get up in front of people. I just don't have the ability to speak. I don't either. I didn't. It's kind of funny, when I was a junior, God put his finger on me in such a way that he allowed me to tear my ACL, and I realized that basketball was my God, and God said, "There's more to life than sports, and I want you to be a part of it." And he turned my focus away from sports, and he said, "Go ahead, start to learn how to talk in front of people." So I took a speech course and offered a speech. First time in my life, I thought I was going to die. And the Lord said, "Okay, now we're gonna send you off on a mission trip." I went down on a mission trip, and I met up with a youth group from Pennsylvania. And I swore I would never, ever, 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 ever go to Pennsylvania. And God said, "Ha, ha, ha." And he brought me out to Pennsylvania. It's just kind of funny when you give your life to God, the different twists that life takes. I think of E. Robert Jordan. We were talking a little bit about the history of E. Robert Jordan recently with a couple guys, and talking about how the Lord had him born into a broken home, a horrendous broken home, raised literally on a garbage dump, and beaten and raised to be a hater, a bitter young man, a fighter, a scrapper, fending and thinking of nobody other than himself. And God puts his finger on that person and says, "I want you to be in ministry for me." I think of John Newton, who was on his father's ship, a slave ship, and became so detestable that even the sailors detested him so much that they put him in chains and put him down in the hold with the slaves. He was a prisoner as the captain of his own ship, and yet God grabbed that life and turned it around and said, "You belong to me." It's amazing that life takes these different turns, but the proposition of our message this morning is simply this: when God writes the story, be prepared for some unexpected twists. Well, what kind of unexpected twists can we expect? I mean, it's kind of oxymoronic or a little paradoxical, but if we're supposed to expect the unexpected, what kind of unexpected can we expect? It's a good question. I'm glad you asked it, because our text this morning shows us two significant twists that we should learn to expect. The first twist is simply this: God's blessings, unacknowledged, pose a threat. We don't think of it this way very often, but as we open up this chapter, as God opens up this chapter, verse 1, "When man began to multiply on the face of the land," flip back to chapter 1 for a second. Chapter 1, verse 28. God had just made man in his image. He made them male and female. And chapter 1, verse 28 says, "And God blessed them." And what's the content of this blessing? "And he said to them, 'Be fruitful and multiply.'" We come to chapter 6, verse 1, and what is man doing? Man is multiplying. Therefore, man is experiencing God's blessing. Man is experiencing God's blessing. Man is fallen at this point, and fallen man is experiencing God's blessing. We saw in chapter 4 that man is experiencing advances in culture, that music is being developed. He's experiencing advances in industry and technology as he's working with metals, he's working with herds, and he's working with agriculture, and things are making advancements, and God is allowing fallen man to be blessed. But as he's being blessed, man is not recognizing the God that's doing the blessing. Remember when we read, there shall be showers of blessing, Ezekiel chapter 34? The whole point of the blessings is that they might know that I am the Lord. That I'm the source of their blessings, and they belong to me, and I belong to them. That's the whole point. But as man receives God's blessings, and he rejects the God of the blessings, he forgets that every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom is no variableness or shadow of turning. We forget the God of the blessings. And when we forget the God of the blessings, life begins to take a tailspin. This is a common theme throughout Scripture. Ezekiel chapter 28, where he's referencing the king of Tyre, and behind the king of Tyre, demonically possessed, satanically controlled, he addresses none other than Lucifer. He says, you were the perfection of beauty. You had all wisdom. And it talks about how he was adorned with jewels, and he was placed in a position of high esteem as the guardian cherub of God's glory. And he says, and in the middle of your blessings, in the middle of your beauty, your heart was filled with pride, and you forgot that it was me who put you there. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 10 through 12, God warns his people, you're going to come to a land, you're going to possess houses that you didn't build. You're going to reap from vines, and you're going to reap from orchards that you didn't plant. You're going to drink from cisterns that you did not dig. And when you get into the land, and you live in those houses, you eat from those fields, you drink from those wells, I want you to be careful so that your heart doesn't forget me. You got all the blessings. Don't forget that it's me who... Psalm 73, the worshiper, the pious one, is looking around and he's saying, you know what, things aren't going well for me, but I'm looking at all these ungodly people and things... seems like God's blessing is on them. Seems like everything's working all right for them until I go into the house of the Lord. And then he says, you know what, my eyes were open because I understand that you have put them in... what does he say? Slippery places. You've set their feet on slippery places. Why? Because you've loaded them up with blessings. We don't think like that, do we? That God's blessings would be a slippery place to be? Romans chapter 21. Mankind in general has a pattern of rejecting God. It says that when they recognized all of the greatness of God, they didn't recognize the God of the greatness. It says they forgot him, and they forgot to give. Let's go there, Romans 1. Romans chapter 1, verses 21, 22. Although they knew God, they did not honor him as God, or what? Or give him thanks. But they became futile in their thinking, their foolish hearts were darkened, and claiming to be wise, they became fools. And so on and so forth. But the crux, the turning point of what happened in these people's lives is they knew it was God, they saw it was God, but because they failed to recognize and thank God for all of his blessings, their lives took a dramatic shift. So much so that at the end of that passage, it finds that they're engaged in homosexuality and all sorts of heinous and unspeakable sins. So the psalmist says in Psalm chapter 50, speaking on behalf of God, he says, he who gives me thanks gives me the sacrifice that I'm looking for. If you recognize that every blessing that you have comes from me, then you've begun to get a handle, a grip on how life works and how it's supposed to work. So God's blessings, unacknowledged, pose a threat. There's three threats that happen to man at this point of the story. We see the first threat is the threat of compromise. Compromise happens when good people become preoccupied with low-level pleasures. Look at verse 2. The sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive, and they took as their wives any they chose. The Lord said, my spirit shall not strive. ESV has abide in, probably better contend with or strive with. My spirit shall not strive with man forever. For he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years. What we see here is that daughters were born to man. The subject of verse 1 is man. We come to verse 2. The sons of God saw the daughters of man were attractive. What we see is that as God is blessing man, some good people get their eyes off of God and start putting them down low, and they become distracted with things that are even good, but they're lower pleasures than the pleasures that we ought to have our affections on. Colossians 3 says, so set your affections on things above. Things above. But they became preoccupied with the affections of things in this world. Now, this is a controversial passage. And much of my time this week has been wrestling through the positions of this passage. And before we get into this at all, I want you to get the bigger picture. The most important part of this passage is this, that wickedness finds its way onto earth, and God is going to have to judge that wickedness. Okay, that's the main point. Man who's fallen away from God has fallen into two categories. Those who are calling on the name of the Lord and those who walked away from God's presence. There's other sons and daughters, but they all fit into these two categories. And as life moved forward, those who've walked away from God's presence are doing more influencing on the good than the good are on the bad. To such a degree that at some point God has to step in and say, enough. I'm going to start over. And he wiped. That's the point of where this is going. Now, we get into the controversy just for a minute. I'm going to take the position that the sons of God in verse 2 are people. There's other positions out there that say it's demons, and you come to a couple texts in the New Testament where it seems like it could lend some credibility to that fact. We come down to verse 4. It says the Nephilim, in the Greek it calls them the giants, were born unto men. At the end of the verse it says they were giants or mighty men of old, men of renown. So there's some confusion as far as demons cohabiting with women and producing this superhuman race of giants. The whole point of that section is that they became giants in character, not giants in stature. And there were larger men than we have today. We look at Goliath. We look at, I forget if it's Sihon or Og, whose bed was 13 feet long, made out of iron. He was a huge man. We have to remember that the genes that were coming down from Adam were stronger. They were different than what we have available to us today. There probably were what we call giants, but they weren't the result of demons cohabiting with women and producing this super race. Why is this men? Just real quickly. The reasons break down in three categories. Grammatically, the sons of God does and can refer to human beings. In Exodus chapter 4, verse 22, Deuteronomy 14, 1, Isaiah 1, 2, the concept of man being called children of God or sons of God is used in this way. When the term sons of God refers to angels, it never includes demons. It always only refers to angels who are on God's side. In fact, when it's used in Job chapter 1 and chapter 2, Satan is distinguished from the sons of God who are presenting themselves to God. The word sons of and the word daughters of, besides having a biological obviousness to it, can also mean those having the nature of. So Abraham is a son of 100 years. Sarah is the daughter of 90 years is the way the Hebrew terminology works. They have the characteristics of. In 1 Samuel, Saul says, you're the son of a wicked woman, as he speaks to his son Jonathan. You have the same characteristics of your mother, who was herself wicked and calls her immoral. What this title would do then for us is it takes not just the Sethites and the Cainites, the followers of God and those who walk away from God, but it takes everybody, and it allows us to take them and put them in the categories. There's other sons and daughters of Adam and Eve, and they fell into one of two camps. They either followed God or they walked away from God. They had the characteristics of those who are sons of God, or they had the characteristics of those who became daughters of man, followers of man, those who bore the nature of man on earth apart from God. Grammatically, it refers to men. Contextually, what we have is probably a reference back to chapter 4, verse 26, at the very end of the chapter, where it says, after Seth came on the scene, men began to call upon the name of the Lord. And there's two ways of interpreting that, as you translate that. Man began to call upon God's name, or man began to call himself by God's name. They identified with the name of God. Sons of God would be a proper translation of what the relationship would be at that point. Contextually, it fits. The title refers to an identity of people that's climactically reversed in verse 4. The Nephilim in verse 4 means the fallen ones. Those who used to be followers of God have now become the fallen ones. They've fallen away from God. They've walked away from Him. An identity switch happens on a large scale at this point. We see that God's judgment, verse 3, my spirit shall no longer strive with angels, demons, or man. Man, the judgment that God is going to bring down on planet Earth isn't for angels, it isn't for demons, it's for man. And He deals just with man at this point. So there's several reasons contextually, and then theologically, angels are never said to be capable of marriage. And this is what is taking place. The word take as their wives is the idea of marriage. It's never used of casual sexual relations. And so there's marriage that's taking place. And Jesus says in Matthew 22, verse 30, angels are incapable of marriage. Angels aren't a race. They don't reproduce. And so they're incapable of reproducing. There's no seed for them to continue and reproduce. Man is a race. Angels are created individually by God. Even if angels were capable of reproduction, it would violate God's law of reproducing each after its kind, after its own kind. And if there were children that were demon man children, would their souls be demonic or anthropomorphic? Which category would they fit in? Would they be redeemable or would they be irredeemable? Because Hebrews says Jesus came in to help not angels, but man. And so there's some theological implications that are at stake here. Now, that means that when you come to the New Testament texts that deal with this, 1 Peter 3:19, 2 Peter 2, 4 and 5, and Jude 5 through 7, that you have to interpret those passages one of two ways. They're either the angels that did something back there, and probably the best way to understand those passages is that demons were behind, demons were involved in the wickedness that ravished mankind at the time. They didn't take physical bodies and cohabit with women. That's something that doesn't happen, can't happen. So you have to understand those passages at least to include them in some way as behind what's going on. So that's what's going on. But the point is this. People who were good became bad. And there's a process. The process is these good men who were in the line of Seth, men who called themselves by the name of God, men who called upon the name of God, were somehow so radically transformed that rather than being termed sons of God any longer, they are known rather as the Nephilim, the fallen ones, those who've created an egregious error against God. How did this happen? Well, it says there in chapter 6, verse 2, it says, the sons of God saw the daughters of man. What a loaded word. The idea is the same as in Genesis 6 or 3 verse 6 when Eve, she saw the fruit that it was good, and she what? She took it. It's the exact same words that are used here. Look what it says, verse 2. The sons of God saw the daughters of man that they were, the word there is, good. And they took as their wives any they chose. It's the same pattern that we see a little bit later in the book of Genesis, chapter 12, where Pharaoh sees Abraham's wife, Sarah, that she's attractive, and he takes her. It's the same thing that David does in 2 Samuel chapter 11. He saw the woman, that she was beautiful, and he took her. The whole point of this is that the scene somehow worked in these men to such a degree that it changed their behavior. Well, that happens to them, but that never happens to us, right? The things that we see never changes the way that we act. Or does it? Compromise happens to good people when that which is outside of us, the things that we see, we touch, we taste, we feel, we become so enamored with them, either they become good and we desire to take them, or they become the only reality that's so bad and all we can see is life at this level. And everything that happens on a lower plane. And it changes us the way that we look at life. What became their focus also became their objective. And these men became preoccupied with low level pleasures. They didn't have their eyes on things above anymore. What mattered most was what happened on this plane. The book of Ecclesiastes talks about it and he says, all of this happens under the sun. Ephesians says, you aren't under the sun kind of people. You are people who have your feet planted on planet Earth, but your station is in the heavenlies. But these people became Ecclesiastes kind of folks. They were living all of life under the sun. And only here matters. Only now matters. Well, you try having these talks with our teens, don't we? You got to realize that there's a day that comes after today. So you've got to drive the speed limit. You've got to make choices today, because everything you choose today affects what? Tomorrow. And it's a sign of maturity when a young person begins to make choices, not on the here and the now, but with the bigger picture in mind. But that's what's happening at this point. Good men are becoming preoccupied with low-level pleasures. Now, these daughters of man, if you have the sons of God being those who are characterized by those who follow God, the daughters of man would be those who are attractive on the outside, but aren't in the spiritual category of the sons of God. And so what you have is these followers of God reaching across and making determinations based not on the character, but based on the physical attractiveness, on the outside, on the externals, on the beauty, whether it's of a voice, of a body, of a whatever. We wouldn't ever do that now, would we? You ever watched a commercial recently? The whole point of a commercial is that what you see will determine what you get, what you take. Okay? That's the whole point, folks. And the more that we have available to us of this kind of commercialism, of commodities available to us, the more we're inherently in danger of being distracted with low-level pleasures and not setting our affection on things above. The threat is first compromise, but once compromise occurs, corruption is closely behind. We see that this happens, verse 2, they took as their wives any they chose. What happens at this point when compromise has taken place is that desire dictates indiscriminately. Whatever I want, I'm going to get. I want it now, I'm going to have it, I'm going to take it. And so the desire, it says, they became locked in by their lust. They chose. They have this freedom of choice. God made man with a freedom of choice. But freedom of choice doesn't equal freedom of will. They had a choice. They could choose anything they wanted. But eventually, these men became locked in by their lusts. Romans chapter 6 says this, "Do you not know that if you present yourselves to anyone as obedient slaves, you are slaves of the one to whom you obey?" We have this idea. We know that God has given us freedom of choice. He's given us free wills. Okay, so I can choose anything I want. But the more I choose based only on my desires and not God's desires, the more I lock myself in as a slave of what? My desires. In fact, as I start to make choices based on what I want, my preferences, my ideas, my whatever, the more I base my choices on me, the more I get locked into a mode or a pattern filled with self-appeasement, self-approval, and lust. And so in their freedom of choice, they lost their freedom of will. They could not choose that which is good. In fact, Romans says, there is none that chooses good. No, not one. Freedom of choice, yes. Freedom of will, no. We're locked into choosing wrong. And so this desire dictates, it says they became accustomed to blessings, they became enamored with their blessings, and finally they felt that they were entitled to the blessings. I think that this generation that we have, post-World War II, never seeing anything about the Great Depression, never knowing what it is to fight a war, never knowing what it is to endure hardship, but having it better than our parents had it before us, I think this is the most dangerous and weakest generation that America has ever had. Because we've become accustomed to blessings. We've become enamored with our blessings. And now we feel that we are entitled to our blessings. And so we find ourselves in the situation that we find ourselves politically, spiritually, morally. And it's exactly what happened back in the days of Noah. Is it a surprise? Is it a surprise? It has to happen this way, folks, because Jesus said, as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. But what happens then at this point, when I feel that I'm entitled to these blessings, is that I have a need to manipulate my own outcomes to fulfill my desires. They saw, so they took. They didn't wait for, you read through chapter 2, God made man out of the dust, breathes into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. Then he takes one of his ribs, and he forms it, and fashions it, and crafts it beautifully. And then the next line is so beautiful. And he brought her to the man. There wasn't that waiting for God to bring. It's, I want it, so I'm going to take it. I'm going to manipulate my circumstances so that I get what I want. Now, when we put it in that terminology, you know, we don't like to say, so I take whatever I want so I can get it, have it, mine. But do you ever manipulate things to get what you desire rather than waiting for God to produce the results? Oh, man, now that's a whole different story, isn't it? I watched the life of David unfold. And David is standing in the cave, and Saul comes in. And all his buddies say, hey, this is your opportunity. David says, I will not manipulate circumstances to my advantage. I'm going to wait for God to deal with this man because God put him in place. Everybody's asleep at night. And they say again, David, here's your opportunity. And David says, I'm not going to manipulate this to my advantage. I'm going to wait for God to deal with this man. Nabal refuses to give David any provisions for his men. David goes and says, that's it, he's done. And on the way, Abigail comes and says, David, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't manipulate things to your own advantage. Let God take care of my foolish husband. David says, what was I thinking? Thank you so much. I forgot all about that. They're going out of town as Absalom is ravaging David's wives, and he's taking over the palace and taking over the kingdom, and David is slinking out at night. And up on one of the hills is Shimei, who's throwing rocks down at David and cursing him and calling his names. And Joab says, David, let me go up and thrust a sword through that guy, that dog of a man. And David says, Joab, I'm not going to manipulate things to my advantage. I'm going to let God deal with him. In fact, maybe God put him there for me for now. When you look at it this way, this looks really gross, and we're never like that. But when you start to think about the fact that this is good men who've become distracted by low-level pleasures, who compromise and now have begun to operate by the dictates of the flesh, the dictates of their desires, and now they've begun to manipulate circumstances so that they get what they want, and it doesn't look like them, it looks like me. It looks like us. It looks like you. And until we can take this passage and look in the mirror and say, God, help me, we've missed the point. And so he says, these desires are dictating them, the desire characterized by a disinterest in the needs of others. They saw what they want, so they took it. In fact, they took as many as they wanted. The idea is there that they were polygamous relationships. They want one, they take one. They want another, they take another. Is there any thought to the wives that they take? No. Look down just a little bit further. End of verse 4. They're mighty men, men of renown. They're men of strength. Men of renown has the idea, men of the name, men who've done feats that are talked about. Go down just a little bit further. Verse 11. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with, what's that next word? The only way that I can get what I want when I'm up against somebody else who wants the same thing is what? Well, just go to the nursery, okay? Two kids want the same thing. What happens? The bigger one wins. That's not, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. The bigger one wins. Same thing's happening here. But as desire begins to dictate, I want what I want, so I'm going to manipulate to get what I want to get, I have to do it over the dead body of somebody else, over the dead character of somebody else, over the whatever. But I'm doing it violently to get what I want. It's a desire that is totally disregarding the needs of others. So they became preoccupied with what they saw, and they end up taking it. It says in verse 4, this corruption results in the Nephilim, the fallen ones. The only other time the word is used in chapter 13 of the book of Numbers, when the spies go into the land, they come back and said, these are Nephilim, they're fallen ones. They're the idea referencing back to this text. These are men of renown, they're huge. We're just like little puny grasshoppers in their sight. All they have to do is fall on us and we're dead meat. But the word Nephilim means fallen ones, and it speaks to their identity as corrupt individuals. It says, end of verse 4, they're mighty men. Again, the word is gigantus in the Greek. But the whole point is that they've become men of the name, men of renown, the end of the verse says. Men who are mighty, men who are stronger, perhaps bigger than others. So might makes right. You've heard that phrase, might makes right. Okay. If I want it, I'll get it, and this is the way it's going to be because I said so, and I'm in charge because I'm bigger. This has truly become an era of the survival of the fittest. Aren't you thankful that we don't have the survival of the fittest today? The only reason that we're having the healthcare squabble in the United States of America that we're having today is because there isn't the survival of the fittest. We don't believe in the survival of the fittest. But in fact, we believe that every soul is made in the image. Folks, the only reason that we have the realities that we know today is because this book has changed all realities. Because left to ourselves, might makes right, and only the fittest survive. You understand why God looks down on earth and says, this grieves me. I can't allow it any further. Indiscriminately, they became reckless and regardless of God's boundaries, taking more than one wife, mixing with the ungodly, lying. They chose any that they wanted. Again, lest we look at them and say, shame, shame, shame on them. The whole reason for this story, as Moses is giving it to the children of Israel, is saying, listen, you take note, because this can be you. Good people become enamored with low-level pleasures and compromise to their own corruption. And eventually, there's the threat of condemnation, where mercy is withdrawn irreversibly. Verse 3, the Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with, contend with, man forever, for he is but flesh. His days shall be 120 years. The emphasis here is on the spirit-flesh dichotomy, not a dualism that speaks of the opposition between the spiritual and the physical, but it speaks of a dynamic where the integrity of the one is in line and linked with the integrity of the other. So Paul says, don't let your flesh pull you down. Don't yield yourself as servants to corruption, but yield your flesh, your members, as servants of righteousness. Just because it's flesh doesn't mean it's bad. But don't let your flesh act fleshly. Let there be an integrity that says the spiritual component of you energizes the physical component rather than the physical component of you dragging down the spiritual component. And so God is saying here, my spirit, the spirit that is working inside of man and calling out to that spiritual side of man and trying to draw him back into a spiritual integrity between his physical life and his spiritual life. There's a striving that's going on. Not because flesh by itself is bad. Jesus Christ took on flesh. But flesh left to itself in its fallen state is fleshly. And God says, you know what? At this point, man has given up the fight. He's given up a listening ear. He's no longer concerned about the integrity of his two parts, his bipartite nature. He's no longer concerned about the spiritual realm. He's only interested in living physically. And so God says, because of this, my spirit will no longer strive with man. I think this is one of the scariest verses because this emphasizes God's systematic approach to sin. God works and he works and he works. And he calls and he calls and he calls. But someday, one day, you'll hear God's final call to you. God's final call. You familiar with that song? Where God says, I've called for so long, but I'm done. I'm done. You've had every opportunity that I will give you. I will give you no more. Now, I turn you over to yourself. What a scary place to be. Over in Romans chapter 1, verses 24, 26, 28, it says, and God turned them over to fulfill their lusts. What do you want? Have it to the full. Have it to the full. You told me, God, not your will, my will. So God says, okay, not my will, your will. What a scary place to be, folks. What a scary place to be. We think that we can come to God whenever we jolly well please. That's not the way it works. God opens doors and he shuts doors. He gives opportunity for repentance, and sometimes when we tell him no long enough, he says, doors closed. You cannot come to me any further. I'm done working with your heart, and your heart left to itself will never choose me. And that's a scary place to be. That's why when God is working on your heart, you don't tell God no. That's why when God impresses you to pray for somebody, you don't tell God no, because they can't choose God by themselves. God has to work in their hearts. And God says, I'm done working in the hearts of man, because he said no to me one too many times. Abandonment of God leads to abandonment by God. Then we come to the precious words. His days shall be 120 years. He'll fill up his corruption. He'll fill up his sin. He'll fill up his wantonness and desires for 120 years. He's going to fill up his judgment. But during that whole time, you know who's going to be on the scene? Noah, a preacher of righteousness, who says, folks, it's not here yet. Come. It's not here yet. Come. Come. Change your minds. God's still working. Come. 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 That brings us to our second point this morning. God's blessings, unacknowledged, pose a threat, but God's judgments, well attended, bring hope. And you can mark it down. Every time God brings judgment, he mingles it with mercy. You know what? We're out of time this morning. I think the first point is enough for us. Good men, good people, with good opportunities, are so easily distracted by what we see, what we experience on this life under the sun. And we become enamored with it. We feel entitled to it. We manipulate so that we get what we want. And we avoid thinking about the needs of others because we're consumed with fulfilling the needs of ourselves. Folks, this is what happened to people who once worshiped God. And if that isn't a reality in your life, if it isn't being cultivated in your life, you and I can end up looking like those who compromised, who experienced corruption, and were one day condemned. Because if Jesus Christ doesn't live in your heart, if he hasn't saved you, you can for a while, like Cain did, follow along on the outside. You're going to look like everybody else at Valley View Bible Church. But the reality may be that there's somebody here today who doesn't have the reality of Christ at work in your life. And if God is putting his finger on your life today and saying, you know it's you, don't tell him no, but deal with him today because he's dealing with you today.